China really presents a serious threat to Iowa.
To understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest.
The More Freedom Foundation podcast.
So, Rob, how are you this week?
Not bad, not bad. No real complaints.
Did you enjoy the Mission Impossible film?
I did. That was fun. But we've moved on, Rory. We're all about Barbenheimer now. I'm concerned because we're going to probably upload this vastly later after recording it. But when we're recording this in mid to late July, the whole Barbie Oppenheimer thing is a whole phenomenon in the United States. It's very exciting to see two films that are not actually superhero films do very well and fill up these megaplexes in the United States, these film movie palaces that often look disturbingly empty.
Do you think Tom Cruise is a war hawk?
Tom Cruise?
Yeah.
That's a great question. Oh, man. Well, that gets into some pretty deep questions about Top Gun that I feel like I hallucinated this sometimes, but I've had it confirmed from other folks. Top Gun, the new one, was recorded in different versions. And the version that I saw in Turkey as an IMAX thing, I was visiting Turkey at that point, actually has, this is Top Gun 2, Iran name-checked as the enemy in that film.
And I heard it was like subtle when it was shown in America, but I didn't think in Turkey it would be straight up, here's Iran.
Yeah, it was actual dialogue in the version of the film that I saw. And I do wonder why that used to be that way and why it wasn't that way in the version that most people saw in the United States. So that's a very long, deep rabbit hole of tinfoil hat conspiracy sounding stuff that perhaps I shouldn't dive into. But I do kind of wonder if the Top Gun movie was intended as a film to make a lot of money. But also those films are made through very close relationships with the U.S. military. And I do wonder if there was some kind of backroom conversation between a producer or something along those lines. It was like, yeah, definitely make this film about Iran. And then quite possibly in the aftermath of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, they could have said, well, we don't need that anymore. We don't need this to be a massive case for war with Iran. So why don't you just take that out? Because, you know, maybe we're a little more interested in buying oil from Iran now. And that's down the rabbit hole. That's completely, you know, quasi-fictional there. But it is interesting to me that I saw, and I'm, you know, I don't think I imagined this, I sat through a version of Top Gun, and it was like two lines of dialogue that said, yeah, we're going after Iran. And so, yeah, I don't know. That's a very long and involved question, a response to your basic question there. But it's an interesting one, I think.
Are there any other American war hawks you'd like to talk about?
Yes. Today's podcast is on Robert Kagan, who's a figure who may not be familiar to folks as other figures that we have debunked. So I think maybe a little more introduction is necessary for Robert Kagan than a Peter Zeihan or a Ray Dalio. Peter Zeihan, the geopolitical YouTube expert, and Ray Dalio, the famous finance guy who did a big digital push behind a book around world order. Two figures we've sort of dissected a bit in the past. Robert Kagan is much, much less well-known, but I would argue that he is vastly more influential than a Peter Zeihan or a Ray Dalio. Debatable on Ray Dalio. Ray Dalio is, after all, a multi-billionaire
who knows a thing or two.
Knows a thing or two, isn't just invited to speak at powerful places, but is paying to sponsor the events that are taking place at powerful places. So it is Ray Dalio, should he want to be, is probably more influential than Robert Kagan. But Robert Kagan is shockingly influential, and that has to do with who he is and what he believes. So there's a little bit of biography that has to go in here. You know, who he is wouldn't matter if he were some flipped out pacifist or something like that. But what he believes and what he has consistently championed over the past 25 years, coupled with his network, means that he's one of the most influential foreign policy people in the country. It's incredibly frustrating to me. Every 6 months, whether it's in the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post, he'll come out with some big think piece. And that won't make an impact on Joe Rogan or on YouTube or what have you. But every serious foreign policy commentator, whether they are going, those are some good ideas, or ripping it to shreds, every serious foreign policy commentator has to reckon with what Bob Kagan says when he comes down from his mountain to issue a new statement in the Wall Street Journal, a new long read about policy and history. And as we'll get into a little bit, it's always the same thing.
So is he able to set the tone for mainstream media in America whenever he feels like it?
That would overstate it a little bit, but he maintains the tone in U.S. His job, his mission in life is to maintain the tone of military aggression in mainstream U.S. media. He's the smart guy. I listened to a bunch of podcasts. I think one of them, I don't think it was the BBC in general, but I think it's a BBC presenter.
Is it the AmeriCast they have? Their podcast?
Andrew Neil, is that?
Andrew Neil, that's famous. Yes.
He's like a right-leaning British commentator or something like that. I think he's got his own podcast. But yeah, there's Andrew Neil interviewed him, the Washington Post, who apparently also cut some checks, interviewed him many times. And just the worshipfulness with which this guy is interviewed is really perplexing when you consider that he is, he apparently doesn't really like the term neocon. I don't really like the term neocon, actually. I prefer the more accurate and more capacious fail nerd. which is, I think it's, neocon has like some
credibility.
Well, no, the way that it's used on the internet, I feel like it has some anti-Semitic overtones, so I try to get away from it. So I tend to avoid neocon, and I also feel like it leaves out like the whole Obama administration, which is just a whole nother bunch of fail nerds from a different direction. The fail nerd more generally, and Robert Kagan is one of the most important examples of that, is someone who is professionally obligated, I don't know about obligated, but professionally committed to making the case for U.S. intervention everywhere. In the Obama administration, they weren't necessarily, you know, directly neocons or what have you, though Robert Kagan had a lot of influence on the Obama administration as well, which we don't talk about so much. But in the Obama administration, these fail nerds were people like Samantha Power or Ben Rhodes who were like, no, 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 we need to go out and help people. That's why it's important. No matter what the rationale is, you know, we need to go out and crush the Middle East and make it safe for Israel, which is a cliched version of what the neocons want, but also kind of accurately what they wanted. Whether it's that or whether it's Samantha Power's, oh, we have a duty to protect. The effect is the same. It's the United States destroying countries. So I like the general term fail nerd. And Robert Kagan is probably the most prominent of the fail nerds. This is a guy who was a massive advocate for the war in Iraq, something that I think the denizens of the internet are probably familiar with, is a organization from the 1990s called the Project for a New American Century. This was the guys who were like, talking about we need to overthrow Saddam Hussein from the early 90s, and then we need to go after Iran, and then we need to go after Syria, and then we need to...
Are these people that believe the 20th century wasn't America's century and it was kind of stolen by the Soviets?
No, I think that I think they would say that the 20th century was the American century. And this is something that I actually agree with Robert Kagan on, is that, and one thing about his pieces that I've been reading over the past couple of days that I've appreciated, is that he is pretty honest about U.S. power. He's much more honest about U.S. power than a lot of other commentators are. He's pretty, I mean, he actually wrote a book called The World America Made, talking about the post-World War II era, which I think is for a guy who's often very dishonest in what he says publicly, that is an admirable bit of honesty. Shocking thing is that his most, probably came to the most prominence as a huge advocate for the Iraq War for a decade prior to it, massive advocate for hypermilitarization.
What was the Justice for It a decade before it happened?
The idea was just, and this is what he's always supported, is that we should be doing more things militarily. That we are the best. We are great. We are democratic. We are progressive. He's a huge intellectual force. And see the air quotes, intellectual force behind the whole democracy versus autocracy framing. He's not the main guy, but he's certainly a big guy pushing that. So his whole message is that the United States is always about supporting democracy against autocracy, and we should be more willing to intervene in places. Iraq was a good thing to do. I still don't think he's ever really apologized for advocating for the war in Iraq. So anyway, this is a guy who's a tremendous failure. And it was interesting, in one of the, certainly not Andrew Neil, but there was a woman from the Washington Post who very carefully, very respectfully asked him, like, do you think that perhaps the war in Iraq might have negatively impacted the views of the rest of the world of the United States? He's like, oh, I don't know about that. That's ridiculous. You know, just like, no. And the thing is, he will never, ever be challenged on any of this because of who he is. So it's the two things. What he believes, more U.S. military is good no matter what the situation. The United States should always be doing more, invading more, fighting more, threatening more. That is so valuable to the true powers in Washington, D.C., defense contractors. And we've talked about the relationship between Congress and the defense contractors and how really every politician in Washington, D.C. wants war. So because of who he, what he believes, he is, he's, was going to be promoted anyway. So he's the son of Donald Kagan, who is a Yale, was a Yale professor of classics. So he is, I remember in my 20s, I would watch his online lectures on Thucydides and the Peloponnesian War. So he's a very influential guy in forming sort of everybody's vision of what ancient Greek history has to teach us today. I may have some problems with that, but the way that that has been taught, but there's no question that Donald Kagan is an incredibly influential figure. He hadn't died yet when folks started talking about the Thucydides trap 5 or 6 years ago, and I don't think he was directly linked to that Harvard project of talking about this Thucydides trap, this idea that because Thucydides says so, you know, China and the United States have to go to war, that idea, which I think is quite stupid. But I don't think that the idea of Thucydides, well, and those interpretations would have the currency that they do without Donald Kagan. So basically, Donald Kagan was a very influential, very powerful Yale professor who became even more influential by doing something that many people have done over the past. If you're in the academy, if you're in academia and you decide to go conservative, this is something that he did in the 1960s, I think as a response to campus unrest or something like that. Donald Kagan then very quickly became a much more powerful figure on the right. Because there are a lot of professors on the right. So they have a Yale professor who decides, oh, I'm more conservative now. Plus, he's talking about classics. He loves to talk about military history. I mean, he's just scratched all those conservative itches. So he was a prominent and well-beloved figure on the right in the 1970s, 1980s, which positioned little Bobby Kagan extraordinarily well. His dad was a professor at Yale. He got his undergraduate at Yale, and then he went to the Harvard Kennedy School for graduate school. I'm not sure if he got a PhD. No, I think, yeah, he's referred to as a doctor. Perhaps he got a PhD there. So he went to his daddy's university, and then he went to the Kennedy School of Government, which I probably complained about in the past, is a center of power in the U.S. military-industrial complex. And then he got to walk straight to Washington, D.C. and into the Reagan administration. As a pretty young man, he was advising presidential candidates and presidents on what you should do, and this advice has been pretty universally terrible.
Is it basically based on what the classics did, what happened in World War II, that sort of thing, or Does he add anything different to his advice?
He's a historian. And it's interesting. I was going to really, really be pillorying him on the basis of a lot of the stuff that I had consumed before today. But this morning, I actually listened to him talk about U.S. history for the first. This is a guy who's nominally a foreign policy expert, right? This is a guy who supposedly knows what foreign policy is about. And this is fascinating. He is a foreign policy expert who really neither knows nor cares anything about the world outside of the United States. Multiple times he's on podcasts and people are like, and what did the outside world think of the thing that the U.S. did? And he's like, why don't we get back to that later? Like, he just, no interest or any concept.
Puts a pin in it and moves on.
Yeah, no interest or any concept of how anybody else in the world might feel or think. However, he does have some historical grasp of the United States. And he's written books and I think has done the necessary research. I mean, he made it through Harvard and Yale. He's not a complete doofus. And he can at least speak somewhat knowledgeably about the evolution of U.S. attitudes towards the abroad and how that's factored into the politics of different times. I mean, to be clear, I listened to a half hour of it, of him talking about this, and I can point to what I would see as a few glaring misinterpretations, but that's going to happen if I'm listening to anybody for a half hour on something. But really, like, he is a foreign policy expert who knows nothing about the world, has gotten things spectacularly wrong, yet we're all just expected to care and think about what he has to say every 6 months when he issues some pronouncement.
Do you think this is symbolic with American attitudes, with the center of power, of this not really caring about what happens outside of America, but still having massive effects and destroying it in many ways?
Yes. It's part of Robert Kagan enforces something that I've talked about, which is just this deep-dyed ignorance of the world. It's something that the United States has gotten away with. And I used to believe, because of the rise of China, because of something we'll be talking about in another episode, the just European absolute end of tolerance for U.S. garbage, I really did believe that by the end of, say, our working lives, Rory, like, the United States would actually have to know things about the world, like, would actually have to, would get to a point where the rest of the world was powerful enough where the United States had to actually start interacting with other countries as peers and actually have to start making smart moves. This is not something that I no longer believe this will happen in my lifetime. I think the United States will continue to be incredibly powerful and incredibly stupid, and Robert Kagan is a key part of that. I think Robert Kagan speaks with some interest and intelligence about the development of U.S. politics. I'm not saying he's right about anything, but he can have a conversation about that. But he is just completely ignorant of what has gone on in the world. And that ignorance is essential to making the case that the United States has somehow fostered democracy over the past couple decades. We manifestly have not. We had the opportunity to do that in Tunisia, and we basically poured a bunch of money, not much money, poured a little bit of money into strengthening their military enough that they could back a coup, which has happened. Our main impact on one of the least democratic regions in the world, the Middle East, has been backing Saudi Arabia and the UAE, absolute monarchs, in their very successful crusade to crush the Arab Spring, to crush democracy across the region. That's the main U.S. impact.
Who all have horrible human rights records.
Yes, well, they have horrible human rights records, and they have crushed democratic movements, including a democratically elected president in Egypt, in Bahrain. In Libya, they have acted to make certain that no even centralized, let alone democratic, even centralized power has been able to take back control in Libya for a decade. And the impact, the U.S. impact in Africa is similarly malicious. So, yeah, like, we have not to believe that the U.S. over the in the 21st century has been a force for democracy versus autocracy, you have to know absolutely nothing about what the United States has done and what those effects have been for the past 20 years. And Robert Kagan, I mean, he doesn't strike me as semi as illiterate. Like, he has forced himself to not understand what the United States has done over the past 20 years, because the point, unfortunately, of U.S. foreign policy is selling weapons. I know I keep coming back to this. I don't want to sound like a broken record, and creating situations in which U.S. weapons can be consumed. It's not that the U.S. that the weapons industry is that important to the U.S. economy. It's just that it is incredibly important. It's the only business that the U.S. government can completely control. So everybody involved in U.S. government wants to sell weapons.
But isn't it also some things that basically, as far as I understand, every state in America does something in production of the military?
That's true, but I think that it's become less and less of a factor. We were discussing this on the patrons only Discord chat a couple weeks back. The fact that what used to be the case during the Cold War was that yes, it's still very much the case that every state has a selection of contracts, but what those contracts mean is very different. In the 50s and 60s, even into the 70s, and then breaking down in the 80s and going off a cliff in the 90s, there really were production lines in every state that were exactly as you described, Ray. And, you know, every congressman, you know, needed to keep these jobs or what have you. That's not really the case anymore. This was documented, I think, by a Yale historian, as Brennis or something like that. I read a very interesting book, something from Might or Right or something. But documented how actually with the reformulating of the military-industrial complex, it's not hundreds of thousands of folks working on assembly lines anymore. It's more like 2,000 or 3,000 guys with engineering degrees and mostly executives sort of doing mergers. And as we found with the really shameful realization that a year and a half into this Ukraine war, our vaunted military-industrial complex can't put it together to send artillery rounds. It's like, oh, no, we want to do missile, you know, ICBM missile defense that doesn't work. That's what we're going to pour trillions of dollars into. And no, we can't even spool up an assembly line to get you enough artillery rounds to fight off Russia.
Well, artillery rounds, just to let everyone know, I would describe them as the spear of modern warfare. Like, if you have front lines, you maintain them with artillery. Half of all deaths in World War I were artillery, and I think something similar in this war. So they are just your like bare essential of holding the line is you're firing between 5,000 to 20,000 artillery rounds a day. So it definitely adds up, but it does seem like America is sort of, no, we're going to keep all these for ourselves and not really spill things up as much as we should.
No, I don't, Rory, I don't think it's a question of not wanting to help. It's a question of not being able to help. We have sent all our artillery rounds, and the 4 or 5 defense contractors that are left are like, oh, well, gee, thousands of artillery rounds, that's going to cost $1 trillion and take us 5 years to put that together, which is, of course, absurd if you know anything about what they were capable of doing in World War II. And it's a national humiliation we don't talk enough about. But so yeah, which is to say, like, there used to be better reasons why the military industrial complex had so much sway in Washington, D.C. There aren't anymore. It's mostly just about selling really convoluted things that may or may not work. And Robert Kagan is excellent at that. So I think we've covered what he believes. You know, he's all about more military all the time. Who he is, we haven't quite finished that. So he's been seated, you know, in the middle of Republican politics. He moves through 9/11, War on Terror, Iraq era, which is a complete disaster. There's this interesting aspect about him that is not fully appreciated, or he's not mentioned as much as it should be, is that he is married to Victoria Nuland. Do you know who Victoria Nuland is?
I don't know.
Victoria Nuland is at this point probably the third or fourth most important foreign policy figure in the Biden administration. She's an undersecretary of state. She was also tremendously important in the Obama administration. I would say the person who organized the post-coup Ukrainian government in 2014. I know people don't like using that sort of terminology for what happened in 2014. But yeah, after the revolution of dignity, she was the American politician that set up the Ukrainian government.
Is that the one who's recorded to be basically saying, I want XYZ in power, and yep. then XYZ are in power?
Yes, exactly. And also, she also famously said, F the EU, which was a pretty...
Is that not the American motto?
Well, that is
Latin.
It is F the EU. That's an interesting... that's certainly the only thing that U.S. foreign policy has accomplished over the past 20 years is really, really screwing up the European Union. So you'd think, and if that was, you'd think that would be an embarrassment, right? That would be bad for a U.S. politician. But no, not only did she finish her time in power with the Obama administration, she was quickly slotted into the top of the Biden administration. So this is a guy who came up in Republican politics for being super pro-war, married to a gal who is at the very top of Democratic foreign policy politics for being very pro-war, and is most likely going to be, I think that Victoria Nuland is a very likely future Secretary of State. Because from the perspective of what everybody actually cares about in Washington, D.C., she's been extraordinarily successful. Finland, Poland, all these countries are lining up to buy F-35s, which 10 years ago were seen as this ridiculous, non-functional waste of space and time and money.
A lot's been ironed out, and I think the prices have gotten better.
Well, anyway, they're selling like hotcakes now.
Oh, yes,
I think
they're
that's
doing
largely
great.
Down to Victoria Nuland's efforts. So this guy, Robert Kagan, is in the middle of all of these circles of power. There's this narrative now that the neocons, again, I don't really like that term, but a lot of the folks who were discredited by the incredible failures of the Bush administration were redeemed by Hillary Clinton in 2016. And Bill Kristol is the most famous example, is a guy who was nominally a Republican until 2016 and then jumped over to the Democrats. That's not really the case with Robert Kagan. I think he probably held on to his Republican affiliation in 2016, but his influence never really flagged. Hillary Clinton put together some board of worthies, the bestest professors in the country, and Robert Kagan got to be on it, despite the fact that he's just kind of a partisan hack. He wrote an article on American decline back in 2012 that apparently Barack Obama found very influential. So this sort of explains explains the deference that he is always given for his, frankly, kind of silly ideas. Nobody who wants to work in American foreign policy for either political party, nobody who wants to be published in foreign affairs as a serious foreign policy commentator will ever be anything but unflaggingly polite to Robert Kagan, who has networks at Yale, networks at Harvard, networks throughout Washington, D.C. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, which is one of the most prestigious think tanks. And he's married to the likely next Democratic Party Secretary of State. And that's how power works. That's why everybody on Twitter who cares about foreign policy feels obligated to have an opinion whenever he farts out a new article in the Wall Street Journal talking about Munich. Because as we've discovered, Ruri, in our investigations over the past couple days, what does Robert Kagan want to talk about more than anything else?
If it's not the classics, it'll be World War II.
Yeah, World War II. I think the classics is his dad. It is World War II, all the gosh darn time.
Because reading that article you sent me, I was almost just like, is this just a summary of World War II? What's this got to do with anything?
Yeah, yeah. He's the guy, not the guy, but he's probably the most prominent guy who just won't stop talking about World War II and Munich and appeasement and Neville Chamberlain and
Oppenheimer.
He talked about Oppenheimer, did he?
No, it was just relevant at the moment.
Yes. Oppenheimer has got a lot of pop cultural reference. I'm excited that I'm going to go see it.
It's very good. You should.
You can't see Oppenheimer in an IMAX theater in New York City this week because they are
completely
sold out for the rest of the week. I'm going out to the suburbs, to an IMAX in the suburbs. I'm going to watch it with my parents tomorrow. I'm excited. Anyway, sorry, Oppenheimer diversion over. But the cliche, I made a video about this probably almost a decade ago, talking about the only
lovely long hair, a much younger Robert.
yes. So this is
eight years ago.
So that's the one, I think, taking his article of 2014 to task.
Putin is not Hitler.
Putin is not Hitler. That is a key point. But I'm actually talking about a different video, which is the only history Washington, D.C. knows, which is 1938, and the fact that the British Prime Minister at the time made a deal with Adolf Hitler that Adolf Hitler quickly violated, and supposedly if the British Prime Minister had acted differently, then maybe World War II wouldn't have been as long and terrible. That is a whole...
But World War II is just full of what-ifs.
Exactly. Unfortunately, the appeasement, which is what that British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, is regarded to have been involved in.
There was a Nazi king at the time, which also didn't help. Yeah, he advocated, and they said it was because he was having an affair with an American woman, but that was just an excuse to get him out of there. So the Queen's father then took the role, who he never wanted to be king.
Oh, well, sure. That's Edward the Seventh or Eighth?
Mm-hmm. So the king that's in the King's Speech, and it's believed the stress of World War II killed him because he didn't live much, about 10 years after.
So Edward VIII was out by 1936. He was out 2 years before.
But they had to sort of get rid of him because he had he was thinking these Nazi ideas are great.
Yeah, no, he stunk. I think it was more marrying Wallace Simpson that got him.
I heard that was
out.
Just an excuse.
Oh, really? Interesting. But by 1938, had been the Nazi king had been well dealt with. Neville Chamberlain, that image of Neville Chamberlain coming back and saying, "Oh, we have peace in our time, appeasement," has been used for every U.S. foreign policy question ever since. This was used to get us into Vietnam. This was used to get us into Iraq. This has been, someone's got to put together a list at some point of every single person who has been compared to Hitler by the U.S. commentariat. I think one of the most extraordinary things, going back to that video critiquing Kagan, we'll have to put a link in the show notes for this, that I put together, is I think he compared the Islamic State to Imperial Japan.
He definitely did.
Which is just like, I mean, the Islamic State is an existence that is a entity that existed because of the funding of the United States, Turkey, and a bunch of other U.S. allies. And then as soon as that funding was withdrawn, it disappeared. Like, to compare that to Imperial Japan is just...
But the default enemy is always Hitler, and then the second-tier enemy is always Japan.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. So, you know, so Robert Kagan, he's a cut above most people. He doesn't just talk about 1938 and Neville Chamberlain. He also talks about Imperial Japan. So he's a real history buff. And, I mean, sadly, like, the history that people in the United States are most engaged with is World War II, because there's just such clear-cut good guys there.
And a lot of footage.
Yeah, and a lot of footage.
You try to get footage of the Vikings. Hard to get.
Getting easier and easier with AI every week, though, you know? And we like the Civil War a lot, too.
That's understandable.
Really, I think Robert Kagan is the guy that you trot out every 6 months to remind everybody that the U.S. was really good in World War II. Just ignore absolutely everything else that has happened since. And it's incredibly frustrating that this guy is as appreciated as he is and is still invited to give the talks he gives write the pieces he writes.
He's got, I mean, he's on salary to do this. This is what he does at the Brookings Institution.
He's now writing a series of books about U.S. history, which are just basically talking about, I haven't read them yet. If this podcast does particularly well, maybe I'll do a video on one of them. But he just, it's really frustrating, but it's important to understand him because that's what a lot of foreign policy discussion and high-level commentary is in the United States. I'm not saying that there isn't extraordinary scholarship going on at Harvard or Yale or the Brookings Institution. There absolutely are. But it is not the extraordinary scholars who are breaking new ground, finding out new things, doing worthwhile analysis. Those are not the guys who are invited to write, do a long read at the Wall Street Journal every 6 months.
Well, the scholars that might come up with proposals like America Bad, they're not being invited to the big dinners.
It doesn't have to be America Bad. It just has to be like basic analysis of what has actually happened over the... Something I agree with Robert Kagan about is that the United States has been in charge. This is the world that we have made. I would argue since 1917, maybe he'd say 1945. We should want to be better at it. But that is emphatically not what Robert Kagan is about. It's talking about how we are good. We are good already. And we are better than anything else out there, despite the fact that he has a very limited understanding of anything else that is out there.
How much do you think is actually his own opinion? And for lack of a better word, the deep state is saying, you say X, Y, Z.
Oh, I think it's all his own opinion.
Okay. You don't think he's being told to shape things in a certain light?
I don't think, see, that's the key thing where I don't think the United States is a place where I think that if you're a 20-something at a think tank and you're trying to make your way up a ladder, and you will get from somebody higher up there, or you're trying to make your way, you know, just selling pieces to, think tanks or the Washington Post or whatever, smaller journals or what have you, you will get told, look, hey, I understand you've got, you want to say something, this is really interesting stuff you've got here about how the United States played probably the largest role in creating the Islamic State, but we're not going to publish that, man. Like, why don't you write something about how heroic the Kurds are or something like that? Like, I think that's how that goes. I don't think there's like sinister plotters behind Robert Kagan telling him what he should say. No, like, I think that's how it worked. But what I just described, that like, oh, you know, you probably, no, we're not going to publish that. Why don't you write about this? That's how these folks are shaped. And Robert Kagan is someone who's very cleverly shaped himself into the kind of position where he's always going to have a job, because he doesn't just flatter the American public with these things he writes. He also flatters people in power. He primarily flatters people in power. So he's sort of a professional sycophant. And that's a choice that he made. And it's a choice that's been enforced over and over and over. So I don't think that Robert Kagan like is like, oh, I better not say that. I better not say this. I think it's just, I feel like I mention this every other day and probably in every other podcast, but the old Upton Sinclair quote, where it's like you can't get a man to understand something when his paycheck depends on him not understanding it. And I think he knows where the checks come from, and he knows what kind of stuff will keep the checks rolling in.
What was the most controversial thing he's come out with that the sort of American mainstream was kind of annoyed about? Or has everything been boilerplate American mainstream?
It's all been pretty boilerplate. His most famous idea came in a book called Of Paradise and Power, which I certainly read, but I read 20 years ago. When I read it, I was nodding along with it as an eager supporter of the Iraq War. Can't make any excuses for that, but I was 23, and I think probably my entire online presence is an attempt to make up for supporting the Iraq War, honestly, in some ways, honestly. But I read the book back in 2003, and it was a full-throated support of the idea that the United States should go out and be violent and break things. And the most famous formulation from that, a paraphrasing famous dating advice back then, which was men are from Mars, women are from Venus, and it was the U.S. is from Mars and Europe is from Venus. And the idea was that the U.S. is warlike and gets things done, whereas those wimpy Europeans...
Yes, because Europe's never went to war with anyone.
I think we was talking about
recent history.
Yes, recent history. But something that he never reckons with and would never have to reckon with is that Europe was abso-effing-lutely right about 2003. Like, it was a catastrophe. They said it would be a catastrophe, and it was a catastrophe. It was intensely damaging to Europe. Brexit, in my mind, would not have happened without the invasion of Iraq, the U.S. war in Iraq, and the U.S. war in Syria. It wouldn't have happened without the related refugee crisis. It was a 1% thing, and the refugee crisis definitely was like a 5% thing.
But you could also argue a distrust
thing.
Of the government. You know, it was a way of... it was like a way to vote against the mainstream, and the mainstream told you to go to war in Iraq, and there wasn't huge... There was a bit of support when it was happening, but I definitely don't see American politicians being pulled over the coals over the Iraq war as UK politicians are. Like, quite often, if Tony Blair goes anywhere, he's just get shouted war criminal at him.
Yeah, there are very little consequences, and Robert Kagan's career is a great example
blossomed.
Of that. It's. I think there's a narrative that, you know, oh, he was rehabilitated in 2016, but he never went anywhere. He held on to those networks and those seats, despite being entirely wrong about what was going on. I think we should say, like, look a little bit at his most recent piece, most recent big think piece is, this is from February, saying, challenging the United States is a historic mistake. And I think his thesis and that headline are entirely accurate. I think, yes, that is very much the case. Challenge the United States is a huge mistake. But the article's about World War II. It's just nothing.
Yeah.
It's the same article that I was critiquing in 2014, except it's a little more celebratory, like, because he's like, oh, yes, we finally are being very warlike against Russia, the way that I've been talking about since 2014. It's on the scale of decades, but it's like whack-a-mole. You know, he's just like, as a younger man, wanted to talk about taking out Saddam Hussein. We took out Saddam Hussein. And pretty much since Saddam Hussein was taken out, he was not reckoning with the cataclysmic failures of that or other interventions that he was a big fan of. He's just been like, and now we need to focus on Russia and China. Now we need to focus on Russia and China. And finally, in 2018 or thereabouts, the whole U.S. government decided to agree with him and say, yes, that's what we're doing. With, I would argue, already pretty horrifically violent results. Not only is Robert Kagan done incredibly well, I think he's going to continue doing incredibly well, just rehashing the same stuff for as long as he's alive.
So just changing the names and countries and applying it to World War II?
Yeah. You know, Islamic State, a threat on the level of Imperial Japan.
I take it he's not a big fan of Iran.
Oh, yeah, he's not a big Iran fan. And it's interesting, though. He doesn't seem to, you know, he does seem a little more focused on China and Russia. I mean, maybe he's somewhat leery of the neocon reputation and doesn't want to dive in there. And I think that, you know, the focus is, there are plenty of folks in Washington, D.C. who are rabidly focused on Iran to the neglect of all reason, thought, or even prioritization. Like, if you're really somebody who believes that the United States has to have some kind of great power competition, like, why would we be focused on Iran rather than Russia and China? You know, there are other folks, you know, doing that sort of thing. Robert Kagan, I think, operates a little higher. You know, he's
more sophisticated.
He's the snazzy, you know, top level.
The fine
stuff.
Wine.
Yeah, you know, he's the guy who gets to speak at all the events that the politicians come to, and this, that, and the other thing. He doesn't have to be out there in the as a Washington D.C. bottom feeder, putting together stupid arguments for another $1 trillion war in the Middle East.
Are there any countries that aren't America that he does like?
I don't think he knows much about them. It's really quite extraordinary. He's familiar with the broad strokes of Italian fascism and Japanese imperialism and the Nazis, but it's really quite stunning. There was a particular podcast episode I listened with him that was talking about it was mid-2022, it was in the more recent aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and it was just stunning, like the complete lack of knowledge he even had about U.S. policy. He very confidently asserted that the Clinton administration didn't expand NATO, and that's false. Like, that is something that the Clinton administration did. It massively expanded NATO. I believe that was the Visegrad countries. And just like, there was a really key question that he was asked. I had mentioned this earlier, like, did the U.S. invasion of Iraq have a negative impact on the way that the United States was viewed in the world? He's like, not really. I'm like, are you kidding? Did he live through that period of time? Like, literally millions of people in the streets worldwide, and very specifically, I mean, you can find photographs of this, like Vladimir Putin, Gerard Schroeder, and Jacques Chirac, France, Germany, and Russia banding together to say, don't do this, opposing this in the United Nations, in the General Court of World Opinion. And of course, they were entirely right.
But also, things like, even the military heads never talk about that war. They talk about the first Gulf War, but the second one is never mentioned.
Never mentioned?
I mean, quite often to show how powerful and incredible America is. It's like, oh, look at how the Gulf War went. The first so many days, they broke so much land. This is what Russia should be doing to Ukraine. But you never hear anyone really talk about the second Gulf War, the invasion in Iraq. Because they just went in and made the place horrible. There was no great, there wasn't a great strategy of victory. It was kind of just go there and break stuff and hang about.
I think that folks do still like to talk about, to some extent, the career of H.R. McMaster, like to talk about like the first 3 months, because those first 3 months were great. We stormed in there, all kinds of, we're super, super proud of ourselves for beating up a military.
It was joked to be one of the worst in the world.
In the 80s, it was reckoned to be one of the best in the world. And in the self-images of the heroes of 2003, they're still thinking about that, not the place that they'd been starving to death with sanctions for a decade and had already defeated in the 90s. So there was a lot of stuff lionizing to some extent the quick conquest of Iraq. But what we spent most of the, those trillions of dollars on, the occupation, the trying to keep things together, no, that doesn't come up very much. That does not come up very much. And that's the most extraordinary thing about Robert Kagan and a lot of other folks, is just this complete no reckoning with the consequences of actions that they advocated for. Like, just not. Like we've got a lot of really good, if we're talking as scientists, we've got a lot of really good evidence of what happens when the United States just goes for it and, goes and is strong and, blah, 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 blah. We've got lots of great evidence. And they just, it's head over ears, earmuffs, they don't want to hear it. They don't want to think about it. And they just want to move directly on to this conflict with Russia and China, which is especially idiotic because you can't understand the conflict with Russia and China without reckoning with the past 20 years. Can't understand the impotence of the UN Security Council without understanding how abused China and Russia felt by the way we used a UN resolution they gave us in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi and frankly destroy North Africa for the next decade. You can't reckon with how Russia was able to appear to be as strong as it was without the incredible abuse of Europe by the United States over the past 20 years. Like, these are just basic facts that, again, I think we're gonna be able to continue to ignore for the rest of our working and probably living lives, Rory, because we just keep getting away with it. And I think we probably still will.
Does this just show what level of power he's in, that he never really has to apologize or change his mind? He can just keep essentially being wrong and, oh well, I'll just keep basically saying the same thing again.
I think some other folks do get a little bit more challenged than he ever will be. But, you know, he came up in the Republican Party militarist circles, and he's married to the Democratic Party top of the militarist circles. So, yeah, he's anybody who wants a job in this field can never talk about what a clown Robert Kagan is. So essentially what I'm doing is I'm just guaranteeing I'll never get a job.
Any work in the New York Times?
Yes. I'll have no choice but to just keep doing this More Freedom Foundation thing forever.
And always be honest to power?
Well, here's hoping. I'm sure I'll give up at some point. But as long as people
cash in.
Oh, sell out? Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, just like go, sign up with Brookings and be like, I'm telling you, it's really important that we think about the aggressive Chinese. China really presents a serious threat to Iowa. Like, can't tell you.
Yeah.
I'm just imagining you in one of those jumpsuits NASCAR drivers wear, but it's all like military industrial complex companies.
Nice. Yes. Raytheon, Lockheed Martin.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be great.
So when you put that on, we know you've fallen in hard times.
Oh, that'd be that's a great idea. I got to make one of those NASCAR outfits. That sounds hilarious, actually. Though I wonder then, would I get sued by Raytheon and all them?
I think the publicity would be worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I have to look into that. Yeah.
Something another podcast when you get sued by Raytheon.
Yeah, I was wondering about getting sued by Raytheon at some point. But the beauty of being as unsuccessful as we are, Rory, is that it actually would elevate us. If anybody came after us. So
the Streisand effect, I think it's called.
Exactly. So, yeah, there's no chance. I think the chances of Robert Kagan or any of his paymasters ever listening to this are vanishingly slim. And if they did, they wouldn't deign to respond to it anyway.
Mm-hmm. But I'm sure someone will, because they will Google him from time to time and find out what everyone's saying.
It would be nice. It would be nice if, and it certainly worked with the Peter Zeihan episode. I feel like that is.
Do you think he listened to it?
I don't know. I'd be surprised. I'm sure there's hundreds. And that's one of an interesting thing. It's like, despite the fact that Robert Kagan is so much more influential, I couldn't find anything debunking Robert Kagan, whereas there's maybe 1,000 videos and podcasts attempting to debunk
Peter
Zeihan.
That's just because he's always right, you see.
It's true. He's utterly, utterly flawless in his descriptions of World War II.
But he's just too sophisticated for our lot. We can't find critiques on YouTube.
That's true. He's just too brilliant. But yeah, it is in 2014 when I made that video mocking his desperate attempt to make it look like the 1930s. I think he had looked a little bit sillier, but I think it's important to emphasize that we are not in the 1930s now either in any way.
But inflation?
Inflation is going away, Rory, haven't you heard?
Yeah, it's getting there.
It's getting there. The idea that Russia poses some kind of serious threat to Europe has been largely debunked. Like, that is no longer that. Like, that Robert Kagan himself, actually, in one of his podcasts, was like, "I was shocked. I expected them to just absorb Ukraine." If people were watching my YouTube channel, they would have known that would not have happened, but was never going to happen. But that's not what's rewarded. It's not accuracy. What's rewarded
is... It's also the
fact
it feels like if only Poland joined the war, they would destroy Russia. So let alone the rest of them.
I don't know. I think that now that Russia is entrenched, I think it's going to be hard to kick them out of there. But as far as Russia, if Russia were to attempt to attack Poland... I think even if it were to attempt to attack the Baltics at this point,
there's rumors
be
of sort of undercover Wagner doing stuff in Poland, but I think Poland would just love to curb stomp them.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's particularly serious.
But
and even China is not. We've given China the best opportunity imaginable to get big into the proxy war game. And that's part of why Russia is failing so miserably, is because China has refused to jump in. It's just...
Oh, yes, that reminds me. Russia and America are now in the same club of accidentally bombing Chinese embassies.
Russia accidentally bombed a Chinese embassy?
No one was killed, but remember they were bombing Odessa, attacking the grain. They damaged one of their embassies, which I think shows just how accurate these missiles are.
Oh, wow. Could Galaganov.
Yeah, that's a really underappreciated event, I think, in the 1990s. The U.S. killing, I think it was only two or three Chinese.
I remember seeing at least three bodies.
Yeah, Chinese folks bombing the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. I believe fully inadvertently, but that is not...
How the Chinese see it.
Yes, which is pretty key. But yeah, Robert Kagan, very influential guy, much more influential than a lot of the other figures we talk about here. And there's not a lot there. It's just World War II Munich stuff over and over and over and over again that we're somehow obligated to take seriously. And it irritates me.
Well, at least China's a bit more like ancient Japan as opposed to the Islamic State.
Well, yes, that's true. That's true. Like these folks do look a little bit more threatening. What's interesting, though, I suppose, is that in this most recent article, and I guess that is a bit of a switch, he does seem to be making a point that the U.S. can definitely beat these folks. But I think he feels confident.
Does he not always say that, though?
What's that?
Is that not always the sort of punchline is there's all these scary things, but don't worry, Uncle Sam will beat them?
Well, no, the usual thing is the there are all these scary things, but Uncle Sam isn't doing enough to fight them. And that may actually be an indicator of just how confident Robert Kagan is now that he's won. Because he's just like, yeah, like we are doing enough now. We are crushing Russia, and it seems most likely that we're going to buy a ton of weapons to supposedly deter China. So it's a sign actually of just, because normally if you look at that article from 2014, he's talking about, oh, it's a real shame that Americans don't want to invade more things. And now he's like, don't screw with us. We'll kick your ass. We're the best. And it's, yeah. So he's Robert Kagan has won. Man, that probably should have been, that's probably a good closing thought. Robert Kagan has won. And we'll
continue
to win. Whatever
you think of him, Robert Kagan is winning.
Robert Kagan is a big winner. And we'll continue to get paid handsomely for his thoughts as long as he's around to think them.
And we'll catch you next time.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law. And he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire: What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.